What up, what up, what up, Asymmetry? Hello, everybody. Have Todd Schlafer in the studio for CoffeeCast number 2. We started this whole CoffeeCast thing just as more of a convenience, trying to fit in everything that we do at Mirai and also get to speak with interesting and some of our most favorite people. And Todd Schlafer is absolutely at the top of the list for just absolutely tremendous friend, wonderful bonsai professional, and tracking his journey as he's made the shift into bonsai as a professional pursuit and a pursuit of passion in life, making decisions that have challenged his level of comfort to really seize the moment and pursue your dreams. It's been amazing to have him on multiple times and listen to Todd's journey and have him speak to those decisions that he's made. And this one is I think, maybe one of the more important podcasts that we've ever done, because bonsai as a profession is, as much as it's following a dream and as beautiful it is, as it is to work on bonsai, there are realities around the human aspect of pursuing bonsai professionally, the challenges of being a professional, the sort of unspoken aspects of life on the road, the quest to have that dream be as beautiful as it sounds, and then the realities of the challenges of that. And Todd was super open with us in the podcast, and it allowed sort of me and Todd to really open up about just the realities of mental health as a bonsai professional, and the challenges of trying to continue to sort of pour your heart out and share your passion for this art form and still be able to preserve yourself in that process. And you know, I think it's always a difficult challenge to discuss and make yourself vulnerable in a public forum to the realities and aspects of things that we all try to manage and deal with. And for myself, that it's an unspoken constant challenge to maintain your ability to be creative and to share as much of yourself as you can through this art form that is very transparent about you as an individual, and be able to still maintain your capacity to do so and stay healthy in the process. And I can't thank Todd enough for being willing to go there and share his experiences. And as always, we love hearing from Todd. We're super proud of him and the just tremendous ambassador of bonsai he is and has become as his career expands into international work. I'm very proud of this podcast, because I think it is something that needs to be discussed and isn't discussed. And hopefully it allows other people to maybe open up about some of the things that they are struggling with, and how we, you know, kind of help ourselves and help each other as a community and as a level of friendship and continuity that we have all dealing with the same challenges as bonsai plays a bigger role in our life. So enjoy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Saturday morning.
Yep.
We have raged this week.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. I love these intensives.
Yeah, it's a whole... it's like every time we come here during these, it's like reflection on the last year of work that you've done and like where you think you've improved. And then you show up and it's like, oh... yep, there's some more gaps that need to be filled.
Next step, yeah. No, it exists. I, starting out this year in the repotting process, I was like, it'll be kind of a light year at Mirai, mm-hmm. You know, not really that much to repot, feeling pretty good. And then, man, the momentum started to build, and we started to repot more and more, and I was like, oh, wow, this is going to... holy smokes. And then it was
we've run out of pots.
Yeah, and then it was yesterday. Just full on. And the greenhouse is always packed, so that's not really like a measurement of whether or not it's been a big year. I think it's more like you can feel the miles that you put on in the repotting season, you know, particularly with the size and scale of tree that we're working with. It's just very physically demanding. But the repotting intensives where you've got, you know, five people that are all quite aware of what they're doing, it opens the door to just do pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
So it's exciting. It's good to have you out.
No, it's good to be out again.
In the studio with Todd Schlafer for our second coffee cast.
Yeah.
Lime Allen.
Hey, good morning.
Jedi on the soundboard. How'd you sleep, Lime?
Newton would not let me go to bed. He wanted to get up all night, wander around. I think he was trying to chase deer or something outside. So whatever it was, he was trying to get rid of them.
Yeah, I'm sure Will. I'm sure Will Baddeley appreciated Newton's lack of desire to sleep.
He said he didn't hear anything. Although I could hear him snoring in there, so I don't think he heard anything.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. Atta boy, Will, get your sleep on, dude. Good.
Newton's pretty effective at just waking me up.
Oh, yeah, the silent fuzzball ninja. Yeah,
sticks his wet, cold nose right on your face.
Yep, right over you. Dad, I'm right here.
I could just see him peeing on you, too.
Hey, no, no.
tends to pee on everything.
No, he doesn't pee on trees. He pees on...
Yeah, thank you. He does pee on trees.
I've trained him not to. I'm pretty good.
Yeah.
Uric acid.
Huh?
Uric acid.
Uric acid. Yeah, you wish. Right? Finding the good. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Good.
How's the first quarter of 2019 treating you?
It's par for the course. Where I haven't been home for a while, and but it's good. It's like it's repotting again. Like that's kind of what I did last year.
Yeah.
Like up until like in Vermont, I think I was in there in the beginning of. I don't know if it's the beginning of May, end of April, but it's like I repotted from February to April. That's all I did.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, it's back to that, but it's like I was just, excuse me, I was at Amy Blanton's and like she had some trees that we had to repot and stuff like that. And so like over the last 2 years, we did 36 trees. I think, and so, it was good, like, going back there and seeing how the trees that we did repot, how they responded, and it's like, they grew really well. So it's like, oh, good, next year I get to do more, like, design work. So I think, I don't know, I think that'll be, like, a theme where things kind of, like, it'll be heavy repotting a lot of the time for, like, people. It's interesting feeling that out and just seeing, just going with it and just seeing how that... how my work, you know, flows with different people and how you just kind of adjust to it. And
well, it feels like, too, one thing that I've recognized is, like, you know, when you start working with trees, obviously the styling is always sort of the first step for a lot of people, but getting to the repotting process is the most dramatic, pivotal change, right? And I'm always continuously sort of shocked by the shift that happens at this time of year. It makes me wish that we could repot throughout more of the year, you know, just so that you could bring about this change at different times besides this one bum rush while the weather is just warm enough or just cool enough or just short enough days or the buds haven't elongated yet. It's like, it's a real cram session to get everything into this time of year. It's freaking gnarly, you know, but but man, the energy, particularly, I have to say, and I don't know if you have this sensation or not, but when they extend daylight time and the daylight time is longer, just in terms of everybody's clocks, that to me is such a major point in the repotting calendar because it's like, just gained another hour of daylight. Let's get it on, you know?
I know. It's like,
game on.
It's time to really repot now.
Yeah, it's like, spring's here finally. It's like once that's one of my favorite days is when you gain that hour.
Yeah,
me it's
too.
Like, okay, here we go. We're back. We're back at it. But
yeah. This year's been crazy just because You know, with all of the ceramicists whose work we carry, typically we're selling all of it to clients, students, etc. And this year, I sort of chose to make a little bit of a reinvestment in Mirai with using a lot of our collaborators' work on our own trees and sort of changing out some of the pots that haven't been as flattering in the garden and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's been really fun just to get to see, because you see these pot, you know, you see Tom Benda, you see Horst Heinzelreiter and, you know, Jan and Jonathan and Ron and just what they do for a tree. And then you've got, you know, some really prized trees in your own collection that like are still in a very inexpensive, right. you know, imported Chinese pot or something like that. And it's just like, I can't keep doing this to this tree, you know?
Yeah. Because you have all these other trees that have like these really nice containers.
Yeah.
And it's like we know, you know, that this is a business, but we also know like your own personal trees and the passion that you have for trees. So it makes sense where it's like, well, all these other trees are getting an upgrade and this is my tree and it's in this mediocre, but that's what I had at that time, and I hadn't discovered these other people. And it's like, well, no, you get a nice container,
this
and
year,
you get a nice container.
You get a nice container.
Yeah.
So, this year has definitely been that transitional year. There's been no hesitation for using the pots that we have. Yeah, and I think now too, it's interesting because we've got so many pots coming in from a large number of sole distributorships that there's enough now where it's not like we're going to be taking pots out of our students' hands.
Sure.
You know, and that too has really helped to have that accumulation of handcrafted goods, but from enough hands that there's enough of them to supply us with what we need.
Yeah, and too, some, like with like the Jerry Morris spruce. So it's like you had a custom pot made for that.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, but
trying to get to some of those staple pieces that, you know, Jerry Morris spruce is never leaving the garden at Mirai.
Yeah.
Like that was the deal when it was when it came here. And so if it's gonna stay, it needs to stay in something very handsome. You know, like
I do.
It deserves it too.
Yeah.
It's a special tree.
It does.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's
a special tree. You working on, have you had time to work on your own collection?
No. I did over the winter, but then I had to greenhouse everything and just be very careful of of what work I did and what species I worked on too, you know? So it's like, I didn't touch firs. I worked spruce, Ponderosa is a limber, you know, but it was mostly spruce that I had that were just kind of overgrown or, anyway. So yeah, so that I worked on my own trees over the winter, but then actually next week I have some people coming in and we're going to like do repotting. And so like I had always, I don't know, it's like last year into this year, I didn't dislike repotting, but I didn't love it like as much, maybe partly because it's a bit stressful, especially when you're going from collected material into its first bonsai container.
Yeah.
And so it's like that's a very stressful couple hours to do that work or however long it takes. But this year, I missed the window last year on some of my own personal trees. And so this year, like last year, I bought containers. And it's like, this is for this tree and this is for this tree. So when I get home, some trees that I've had in containers that are in my own personal collection or in just grow boxes are going into containers.
Nice.
So it's like, I'm really excited about that.
Oh, very
cool.
So
I got a nice fir that is going in, a big limber that we did when you were at my house.
Yeah.
It's like that's going into containers. And
that's going to be a project.
A few. And it's good that I have people coming in because I'm going to need a couple hands to hold some of those pieces. So
very cool.
So I'm really excited. I'm really excited about that. So
I'm always shocked when repotting, we did Alabama yesterday. Alabama is a Rocky Mountain juniper, the likes of which has never been seen in the bonsai world yet. Anybody who's come to Moriah has seen Alabama and its wood box standing on end. But we repotted that tree yesterday, and I'm always, whenever a tree like that comes in, I am very reluctant to open the box up and start, because once you open the box up and start, there is no going back,
right?
Yep. There's
Game
no
on. You have you finish. You.
There's no returning from it. It's like, and now if I want to stop, I'm going to be building a new box, right? Like that's the. Once we opened that up, it was just like, ah, here we go, and the vortex of time that occurs in a repot that's that intense is crazy, because that tree took what, 4 hours?
Between 4 and 5 hours.
Yeah. Right. And I'm all for, you know, like hammering out repots and being super efficient and like priding yourself on speed and proficiency. But there are just some repots that are going to take you 5 hours. And that's literally the fastest that they can be accomplished for the kind of complexity and sculpting of the root system that it takes to get them into a bonsai pot.
And then to get it in. But then hide your work, you know, so you don't have like big planks kind of holding things up.
It's absolutely. Like, yeah. So make it clean, make it professional, make it appreciable aesthetically. Yeah. I feel like people take huge shortcuts in repotting and justify a lot of crappy technique, willing to show a lot of crappy work and calling it sort of the only solution. And I don't see that as being the way it is. Yeah. But you have to put in an extra hour if you're going to hide all of that, you know? And that's like...
They don't have the patience.
The patience, maybe they don't have the technique. Maybe they don't have the engineering concepts. Yeah. Maybe they don't have the creativity. Maybe they don't have that expectation of what that quality could be.
I feel like a lot of people want to just rush through a repot too much.
I think everybody wants to rush through a repot. Yeah. And I think there's a trade-off, right? Like Mr. Kimura was all about speed and efficiency. We repotted very, very quickly. But you better believe that there were trees at Mr. Kimura's where the whole team was present for one single tree being repotted, and that was going to take 3 or 4 hours, you know? And that was a very special tree where you're hollowing out the root, compressing the root system. It's a $400,000 or $500,000 tree going into a $400,000 or $500,000 antique pot. And it's like, that's going to be a 4 hour repot. It's going to be super stressful. You're going to be able to cut through the tension in the greenhouse with a knife, you know, and there is no reason to try and expedite that process. Like, it is what it is. The thing at Moriah is we're repotting, I mean, the value in the American market doesn't exist, but we're repotting trees of the caliber of those big repots in Japan on a daily basis. You know, I mean, Alabama, that tree's never going to be duplicated in the world of bonsai. Like, no matter what country you go to, there's never going to be a juniper that looks like that.
Yeah.
So 5 hours, I'm pretty happy to take it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a matter of when do you open the box and take that 5 hours out of your life, you know?
To do it,
Yeah.
And too, with the spruces, I mean, that was like, it was crickets in there when we were doing that work.
Yeah.
Because it's like, everyone understands that.
Yep.
The value of the trees, the...
Just the sheer rareness of them. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you're not going to be able to, you can't replace these trees, right?
Yeah.
What was that like seeing two big massive spruce that you'd collected make it into bonsai containers?
Well, yeah, I mean, from the day I collected them and boxed them up until yesterday, I mean, I'd been waiting the entire time. It's like, and I was so excited to see that. One, because I've repotted a lot of the spruces from the fin, but I hadn't out of rock where I found these. So I was very curious as to how they grew, you know, and it's like, what did their root systems look like? And it's like, the root systems were pretty par for a blue spruce, you know. It's like there were some there, but not tons, but on the top, you would expect that it had just grown a ton of spruces by the amount of backbutting that or a ton of roost by the amount of backbedding they had. Yep. But that's like, oh no, that's not really how they.
It's not what it looks like. It's not what it looks like. Isn't that interesting though?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to like when you see a juniper growing, it's a 1-to-1. Like that juniper foliage growth equals root growth. When you see a spruce growing, it's definitively not 1-to-1.
It's not.
When you've got all this foliage growing, there might be a little bit of root growth happening.
Yeah.
That to me is really something to be aware of, because I know people can oftentimes mishandle roots or treat roots as roots. But it's like, well, when you get an old Colorado blue spruce, that's a different repotting technique than a juniper. And a juniper is a different repotting technique than a pine. And all of those are different repotting technique than a deciduous tree. And people, I think, do tend to lump repotting as like a singular skill set. And it's like, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like the more root systems that you look at, the more you start to understand that, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know how many people like really have repotted blue spruces, you know, so it's like they may get down in there and see what the root systems look like, and it could be a bit of a shock because they're expecting it to look like another species that they've dealt with a lot. It's like, no, that's not how these work, so you better be careful with what you have there.
Welcome to the world of elongating species. I've been elongating species have absolutely captivated my mind. Because I've found hemlock to be very similar to Colorado blues in terms of their roots, the mountain hemlock. You know, like we have that one that we put in stone. I mean, it had very, very few roots. We didn't cut a single root off of that tree. We just took out some of the old bog soil and left it just fit right in. You know, like we didn't have to do heavy work on it. It's crazy how little root trees survive with, you know, even how little root trees create. But also, if you give them the right conditions, the Colorado spruce will produce just as many roots as any other tree.
Yeah.
You know,
once it gets in that new, like that new soil.
Yeah.
And it's like you get it out, you put in that new soil, then all of a sudden
it really
like comes to life. But they can just live in such adverse, horrible, you know, anaerobic soil conditions that it's really amazing what they're able to go through. But
when I think like the whole elongating species genre, like when you look at larch, when you look at hemlock, when you look at Doug fir, when you look at subalpine fir, when you look at the spruce, whether it's Engelmann Black Hills or Colorado, the Sitka would be a little bit different as sort of a coastal growing variety. But when you look at all of those varieties, their root systems have similar characteristics, right? They go and grow in heavy, heavy decomposing organic duff, like almost black, mucky, because that's what they need with moisture levels in a more depleted environment to survive.
Yep.
And when you stick that in a bonsai container, you better be on point with watering, right? Just to get it to recover from the collection process. But then you recognize when you come back and repot that that situation has not necessarily facilitated the best reproduction of roots after collection. Trees producing all kinds of buds, you think you're good to go, and then you pull it out and the whole thing falls apart and you're just like, no! No! Why? You know? Engelmann spruce has single-handedly Engelmann spruce and Doug fir.
That's what I was gonna say, man. Too. Doug fir. Yeah, I have an Engelmann I'm gonna repot. When was that? So I was out. My first year here was 2012. So I bought a Kazon container from you. That the Engelmann that we the first time I ever saw rebar. And you bent the top up.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that tree?
Yeah, I know that tree.
I'm repotting that this year,
like
for the first time. So, but before I get back to that, but like, yeah, Doug firs, like their root systems are very minimal, and they don't, like even with, like even in pumice, like they'll throw some roots in there, but they don't seem to.
They don't move into the pumice.
They don't a whole lot, yeah.
They stay in that dense organic mass, and then when you go to repot them, you start breaking up that organic mass, and you're like, wait, there's no, where's all the roots, right? Like, that's the the general vibe. And I find, you know, like Big Dougie, the hollow trunk Doug Fir that we've got last year, I mean, it shed 90% of its foliage right before it pushed all its buds in the spring. And I was just like, holy cow. I mean, that's a really big root problem, probably from being out in the rain over the course of the winter. But that combined with a poor root system, the narwhal, you know, which is a one of a kind Doug Fir.
Yeah.
Obviously, like its lower branch has been super weak. Like Doug Firs are really a challenge. Yeah. The older Doug Firs in particular, to try and strike that balance in the roots that gives them health, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really interested to repot Big Dougie and just see what is going on in that root system, you know? And
since you vacuumed out the...
Oh, I mean, I vacuumed it out. Like, I found great roots, but that was a triage to try and get it to a point where we could repot it this spring. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty positive that there's copious quantities of organic material left in there. Mm-hmm. Hasn't produced enough roots in the new domesticated soil to be able to go in and pull all that out confidently. And I it will be interesting to see.
You're going to do it this year.
Yeah. I mean, I was really hopeful we were going to be doing it, but the container thing didn't work out. So I'll find something for it though. I won't leave it in there another year. Yeah, I can't.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, okay, you repot a couple Doug Firs, but then like to really understand the root systems and how they react, it's like, well, I guess I got to wait a few years now, you know? So it's like, it's all patience, because it's like, you got to let it do its thing and see how it responds and see how it sets buds and see how it grows and then go back in and then see what the correlation between the growth and the root system are like. And it's like, oh, this, they don't grow as... You know, there's not the one-to-one, or there's, you know, this one, it is really pushing well, or I don't know. It's like, it's just being patient and then having to wait and see with all these species, but then just trying, like, as we try to understand them to a little deeper level than what we've known before. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's truly the experimentation process, you know, with our native species. But I think beyond that, one of the interesting things, or one of the things that I always noticed about reading Japanese magazines and whatever articles were translated into Bonsai Today or Bonsai Focus, and you never know if the translation, now having a lot more in-depth knowledge of sort of the way that the articles are shot in Japan and the way that the articles are written and stuff, it makes me question the translations even more. But you never know how good the translations of an article are.
Okay? Sure.
Not to say the people translating aren't doing a good job, but to say the people writing it might be embellishing significantly on the potential for that technique
or its
legitimacy. Okay.
Right.
So, but reading those, one of the things that always struck me still, whether it's legitimate or not, was the discussion of depth that existed, whether the technique was right or wrong. Mm-hmm. There is a discussion of depth, I think, in the Japanese articles and in the techniques. They've really, like anything Japanese, they've broken it down to the finest sort of threads of the fabric. And where we're at now with our native species, I think where we haven't gone prior to now, and I think where we're starting to go now, is trying to tease out those really fine threads and figure out what is it that allows us to take these trees to that highest level of refinement and bonsai aesthetic. And you can't function with a broad brushstroke when you're painting the details of a fine art piece. You can't have a big, clumsy club of approach to the horticulture when you're trying to tease out the tree's most intimate capacities to refine. And we've kind of continuously in the United States sort of bludgeoned this idea of bonsai to death with a big boxing glove when we needed like fine little, you know, finger like dexterity to do the work. And I think that's where we're realizing we can improve still.
So when you first like came back and you started seeing our like the native species that we had, then like if you saw a Doug Fir like from your studies in Japan, what did you pull from? Or when you saw like Sierras, you know, stuff that people hadn't really explored a lot. It's like, so what are the like species correlations between, like when you're in Japan and all that knowledge and then coming back,
yeah,
you know, it's like, how did you piece that together? Or
yeah, that's a great question. I think for the junipers, well, the advantage that I had before going to Japan is I had already worked so much on mm-hmm. our native species. You know, I'd collected them myself in yep. high school and college. I had worked with them a little bit with a lack of bonsai proficiency, but I'd worked with them a little bit. And so I kind of knew where my questions existed. And in Japan, you know, it's not so monochromatic that it's just, for a juniper, it's not just Itoigawa. There are a lot of different varieties, and there are a lot of natural mountain foliage still left on some of the trees. And the Hokkaido juniper was this blue, coarser, floppier, challenging foliar mass that I think set me up to have success with Rocky Mountain and with Sierra and mm-hmm. with California. So that was kind of the juniper derivative of that, were the coarser northern varieties of the native juniper foliage mass, is that in Hokkaido they have a real pride in that foliage. They don't want it grafted over. And I thought that was pretty cool too. I mean, that's almost directly how we feel about our right. native junipers, right? As far as the pines, seeing the white pine have the ability to just explode in length, and then looking at the region where the white pine naturally grew and came from, and looking at our ponderosas and seeing how everybody was sort of working against the power of the ponderosa and not having a lot of success, I was like, well, this just makes sense, right? Like, you build up these buds, you distribute the strength, right? So that one was quite easy. The tough one was the redwood and the Doug fir. Mm. Because the only thing that I could reference for redwood and Doug fir was the foliar structure of Taxus.
Mm-hmm.
And neither redwood nor Doug fir have really any relation to Taxus in terms of the way that they behave, the vigor that a Taxus has, and you know, regionally where it occurs versus a redwood on the coast and a Doug fir in the Alpine. I mean, it's a really poor association, but at least it gave me a methodology to handling a more frond-like growth
mm-hmm.
and where potential buds could occur and how you can direct the strength. And then from there, you know, the Doug fir by far is the most nuanced species that we have.
Was there anything in Japan where it's like the juvenile buds, like on the Doug fir?
No.
It's like that's just
with Doug fir. That's mm-hmm. just Doug fir. Yeah. Yes, I talk about the juvenile and mature buds a lot, and I continue to, I think the thing that continues to motivate me is I continue to try and break the knowledge that I teach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I really try to put it to the mm-hmm. test. So I took Big Dougie after he had recovered and did a heavy pruning on it a little bit later than normal. Back to those juvenile buds. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sitting here staring at them and it's springtime and all the mature buds are getting ready to grow and the juveniles aren't. And I mean, it is
uh-huh.
every single time now, once you sort of hone in on those timings and reasons for the shift, which Doug fir definitively shifts from its foliar growth cycle to its vascular growth cycle earlier, you know, and those components of knowledge like that, realization that trees have a different time where they shift their growth mechanisms came from talking with some nurserymen who were up here trying to figure out how to increase the digging success rate of their oaks for nursery production. And they were talking about how, you know, a red oak transitions from foliar to vascular in May, whereas every other oak is August. And that, to me, just that little sort of mention when I started thinking about Doug fir and the fact that if you prune it past this point, you're kind of screwed,
yeah.
you know, is like, oh, okay, so this is happening with different trees. And also, you know, they said, you know, your roots are definitively growing before your foliage mass is growing. And on Doug fir, that's not the case.
Yeah.
You might dig into a root system that the buds are swelling or even opening, and you might not see a white root tip.
Yeah, nothing.
You might not see any root growth. And that's counter to all common horticultural knowledge. They wouldn't have that experience that we have being as intimate with the root system. And so that whole scenario of the Doug fir was really, I think, a culmination of figuring out all of the sort of lower hanging fruit of the other species.
Yeah. Doug fir is, it's still a mystery.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. It's and a it's mystery. Like, it's pretty, yeah, there's, it hasn't been, and it, I mean, too, it's like, I watch Mirai live, you know, and it's like, I'll go back and look at the, like some of the, you know, supplemental material on Doug Furs, and it's like, to try to like get all that, and it's like, yeah, but like, and the information's great, but it's like, it's not all figured out yet, you know, it's like, there's so many holes in there still that it's like, we're, you're trying to figure out and trying to,
Well, and this is, I think, where like Mirai Live has so much. Again, the common question is, aren't you worried you're going to run out of things to talk about? And it's just like, are you freaking
have you
kidding
done Bonsai
me?
Before?
Like, do you realize what you're asking? Like, do you think Bonsai is that easy? Like, oh, we just talked about it all. Now everybody can do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, this is hard. It's hard. It's not hard to do bonsai. It's not hard to keep trees alive. Like, that is an expected, that is a action that we take. Things happen, but we hope that, you know, that that's the case. It is hard to try and push the degree with which you can have success and you can evolve the aesthetic and you can build the technique to bring about greater change. I mean, and that's...
Well, be poignant with what you're doing.
Sure.
Like, it's like, oh, there's... I'm doing this now because I know this will happen, not because I have the time to do it.
Yep.
Or it's like, no, I have to. I have 2 weeks here,
right?
Or a week where I have to get this done.
This
you know?
Is my so window. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is my window.
So it's like, oh, that's that's.
Yeah, and I just don't. I don't see that. I don't see that changing anytime soon. I think the hardest thing is getting people to, getting people to a point where it's possible for all of the techniques to be executed at a level and quality that you do see the anticipated results, right? Because I think a lot of times we fail to deliver the technique at the level that it needs to be delivered at. You know, and you could go back to wiring. You could say, okay, I'm going to wire a tree. Well, if you wire a tree poorly and half the branches die, the answer isn't, I shouldn't have wired the tree at this time of year. The answer is the wiring technique wasn't very good.
Right.
So if you say it's ideal to wire a spruce right before bud push or at the beginning of fall after the heat of summer, and somebody says, well, I've heard they're sensitive to wire, and you say these are the best times of year, and they wire it then and half the branches die because their wiring technique is off, then they're going to potentially look at the fact that maybe spring or fall aren't the best times to wire a spruce. And it's like, no, it has nothing to do with that,
right?
The wiring technique needs to be on point for the timing technique to be able to.
Yeah, so it's not just timing. It's like the technique, has to be.
And that's that. That's that waterfall effect. Yeah. It's like, well, what soil do you use? It's the composition, and then the particle size, and then the container dynamics, and then the species, and then, you know, your environment over the course of the spring, summer, fall, winter, and then how you fertilize, and then what are you doing with the foliage mass to work with that? And then all of a sudden, it's like the explanation of how to do bonsai well becomes quite big. But you can bite it off in those baby chunks, as long as you're focused on just doing it well. Anything that you do, focus on doing it well. If you're sifting soil, sift the soil well. You know, I mean, like, make the top dressing well. Don't cut the corners, because each of those starts to muddy up the water of what is causing the problem. Did you sift did you make the top dressing and sift out the fines? No, I didn't. You know, did you sift this soil? No, it comes pre-sifted. I don't need to sift it. There is no soil you don't need to sift,
right?
Like, did you maintain some portion of the root system untouched? I mean, there is still soil clinging to these roots, you know, and it's just like, okay, well now, you know, without sifting the soil, screwing up the top dressing, you know, potentially bare rooting the tree, why is the tree showing yellow foliage in the middle of summer, or why did branches die back? You don't know. You no longer know.
Any one of those at any given moment.
Yeah, and this is why, as we repot in the intensives and stuff, even for you guys that have great collections yourselves, are so very proficient, I'm so insistent on just the almost like overly anally insistent on every single step just being regimented yeah. and detailed yeah. because that way you know what went wrong.
Right.
Right. And that way you know yeah. that everything went right. Yeah.
It's not because of this and this and this, because I did it to
because we did it the to best. The best it yeah. could be done, the best that we have the capacity to do.
And like when I'm going around and I'm helping like people repot, it all like to me it starts with the drainage screens.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like every time, like here too, it's like I don't even tear them, mm-hmm. or I'll tear them, but I cut the edge sure. so everything's tight. So and then when yeah. I do my wires, I always make sure like that's those are the two things. Like from the beginning that I really tried to pride myself with. And yep. it's like the wires coming up are tight, you know, yep. there's no, it's like, and if there is, flat. I redo it flat. And when you pull it up, it's just, there's no giving. It's like, yeah. it's tight and yep. the screens are clean, but no one's going to see them. It's like, yeah, exactly. But when someone does,
but you know,
they're going to see how you know. Clean that is.
And yeah.
It's such a mindset.
It's a mindset.
Yeah.
It's an absolute mindset.
Yep. yep.
Mentality too.
It's yeah. an absolute mindset. So I mean, we were trying to get through all those smaller deciduous trees, you know, and we're cutting a few corners to get through them quickly, right? Not hiding the tie downs. I mean, there's not a lot to tie down to, yeah. anyways. But you know, when you start that process, you see it, the house of cards starts to crumble.
Yeah.
You know, whenever you start that yeah. process, and there is a production aspect to some things we could never do that with conifers. We sure. can get away with that with some lower deciduous, but yeah, when you set your sights, the drain screen and the tie down wires are the lowest hanging fruit to already elevate your mindset going into a big repot.
Yep.
I mean, this just makes sense,
yep.
you know,
yep.
Even the way that you take apart the box being super intentional yep. and deliberate and strategic. I think a lot of people tend to pull a tree out of a bonsai pot or the growing container
gosh.
with aggression and lack of yeah. care, and you've already screwed.
Yeah. You've taken some points away from that root system already, and you haven't even done anything.
Yep, and your general mindset is not one that's going to mm-hmm. be successful.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You're in a total hack it away. Get
you're
it
just
done.
In hacking phase. Yeah. yeah, and then all of a sudden, you know, you start tearing things up. It's yeah, yeah.
It's like once things get sloppy, they don't get better.
Nope.
They don't. It's like, I mean, it's just... Nope.
Can't start out with slop.
No.
And can't it's start like, out. You know, there's no recovering from
there's
slop.
There's not.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, and the more that you work on more and more pricey, valuable, irreplaceable trees, the more and more you even... apply those techniques, I think, to trees that are lesser.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes
goodness,
easier.
Yes.
It becomes easier, yep. and it becomes because if you're going to take the time to do it at all, for whether it's a crappy tree or a nice tree, if you're going to take the time to do it at all, why do it poorly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so like working on nice trees, and you see how those improve. You recognize that with a lesser tree, if you put good work into it, it's going to become quite nice or improved too, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, hanging out here so much now, my repotting is like that. Very, you know, definitive. I set the moment. I set my mindset.
Mm-hmm.
There's no distractions. This is what's going on. But it's carried over into life too. And when I go take on a project, I've been taking on things like I pot a tree now.
Uh-huh.
I hang out around you too much. It's,
yeah.
This is very, you have to be slow, methodical.
Yep.
Every thought, every moment or every action has a reason.
Yep.
And there's no just doing.
No hacking. Yeah.
But even if you, like, let's say you take your time over rushing it, like, really, what in the scheme of time
was it? Oh, yeah.
What's the difference? How much time do you lose? Like, maybe, like, on something a little more difficult, maybe you lose an hour.
Mm-hmm.
On something easier, maybe you lose 15 minutes.
Sure.
Yep.
So it's like
true.
In the scheme of things, it's like, to slow down and do it well, you're not losing weeks. You're losing, you know, minutes.
Seconds,
or
minutes.
Yeah, it's really, it's not a big time suck. Unless you're trying to just knock out a ton of trees in one day and whatever, you know, but it's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, and then when you think about the fact that this is a pursuit over years,
mm-hmm.
so that extra, that extra hour yep. in one of the most pivotal operations that the tree experiences in its entire existence as a bonsai, that's setting it up for success for, you know, 50 to 100 years, if all goes well, that extra hour in the course of that 50 to 100 years is a blip. It's a snap, right?
And can mean all the world.
And can change everything. Can change everything about whether that tree ever sees 50 years.
Yeah.
It's such a, bonsai is such a perspective giving art form. I mean, we're working with these tiny trees that are hundreds, if not thousands of years old. That alone is a lot of perspective.
Yeah.
But you're also functioning on this constant teeter-totter of life and death.
Yeah.
And making sure that you give the tree every single chance to always land on the life side of that. And it's just, you know, the more proficient you get, the more disciplined you get, the more technique you're able to master and apply, the more that the teeter-totter just simply stays on the life side of that tipping point, right? And so it's like life, the living side of bonsai's approach starts to get heavier and heavier and heavier and kind of dominate the teeter-totter. And why would you not put more weight on the living side of the teeter-totter, I mean, you know? It's like, it's fascinating. I mean, that's where this year repotting has been back in. See where there were flaws in some of the repots that we did 5 years ago. Pockets of roots that didn't thrive, and look at that situation. A lot of watering corrections, looking at how we've been watering the trees and what has resulted in that, and how we can be observing the trees to recalibrate our watering when we see these very... They're very obvious signs when you know that it's caused a problem, but they're very obscure when you didn't know what to look for. And so now, particularly with the Doug fir, I think there are some very dramatic things to be looking at. But the junipers and dealing with some root-related issues and stuff, I think we're gaining a lot more insight into how to be more proactive with that. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm into it. What are your goals for the rest of the year? What do you got? What's Todd Schlafer?
Let's see, the rest of the year. I'm going to be home for a couple weeks working on my own stuff.
Nice.
In the beginning of April, which is rare. And so that'll be nice. It'll be nice doing that, but then I'm going to show in Michigan that I'm going to, I'm one of the guest artists. I'm going to go to Vegas where I'm one of the guest artists. I'm going to California, which is neat because I haven't been to California. Yeah. I haven't been to Vegas either. So it's nice kind of expanding that, my footprint.
Where in California are you going?
Southern California.
Ooh.
All there. Yep. Robert Pressler is bringing me down to do, 10 days, 2 weeks down
Bob's
there.
Bob's a good dude.
So, yeah.
Bob Pressler's a good dude.
I'd never met him before, and then he asked if I was interested, so I called him and just talked to him on the phone about, about doing it. So that's exciting.
We're out in the mitten.
What's that?
We're out in Michigan, the mitten.
That's a great question. I'd need to look on my phone and see where it is. But it's at...
Man, Lime put you on the spot.
Hardcore. It's like if I can look at my phone.
Put you on blast.
It's
hardcore.
Not Ann Arbor. I don't know. I don't care that I don't know. I can look at my phone, and it's 2 weeks before I'm there, I'll know exactly where I'm going.
That's what it is.
My Meijer Gardens.
Oh. Yeah.
There's I think that's a supermarket or something, but they sponsored this big garden or whatever there. Anyway.
Interesting.
So, yeah, but next year I'll be at this year, I don't know, it's still putting time in and still personal collections, still workshops, still, I'm gonna collect probably a little more this year. I've been trying to make a little more time for that, just because I have access to an area that I hadn't had before that I'd like to, you know, to go into.
Mm.
And
is that exciting when you get your foot in the door of a new area?
Well, yeah, it's like the area is not necessarily new, but it's I hadn't had permission to go there. And right. So it's been a dream of mine for, I don't know, 10 years.
Right.
And so, like, getting the person that has permission to talk to someone to see if they would give me the, you know, uh-huh. to if the permission could be handed down.
Yeah.
And so,
going through that whole process, it's almost like, you know, when Harry Harrow had a relationship with the people in Jawbone. And then everybody was like, what happens when Harry, mm-hmm. you know, is no longer collecting? And that you know, like, there are similarities to that in sort of what you've experienced, I think.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
And I mean, when I got it, it was one of the top 10 favorite days of my life. It really was.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, because I almost started tearing up because yeah. I just... And I got when I got access the next day, I contacted them, and it's like, I'm coming up. And there's like, and they text me back. It's like, there's 2 feet of snow up here. It's like, great. And so I just drove up. I drove into as far as I could, and then I just hiked in, and I just hiked around the area because yeah. it's like, I'm here by myself.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. it really was just one of the... So anyway, so I want to, you know, go to that area. But then next year, like, I'm going to Europe. And so
Switzerland,
I'm going to Switzerland.
God, I'm so jealous of that one. That's a big one.
Well, yeah. And so, but yeah, so Switzerland, Germany,
uh-huh.
I'm going back to Germany.
I'm jealous of that it's too. Like, I've never been to Germany.
Oh, you haven't?
Never. I'm half German.
All right. Well, you're going to Belgium. I'll be in Belgium. And so just, I know.
The
I'm
European,
just saying,
so here's what
it's I had, just, but it's a year, it's I'll a year
in,
out.
But I'll be in Spain right before Belgium. And so I'm going to be in Spain and then Belgium and then just extending it to Germany. It's like, what, am I just going to live in Europe for the spring?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to try to do.
Brad's not coming back.
Yeah, it's like taking up residency or, you know, like be almost 3 weeks in Europe.
Yeah. But I'm going to, I don't know, I'm trying to get more work in Europe for next year, you know? So it's like, when I was out for the cup or for the trophy, yeah, that was when we were at the, like this, that's how the Switzerland thing came up. We were at dinner and I was with Adam and who you had, Adam Johnson, you had him on a podcast, yeah. you know, and he's a student and he, you know, he's, when he found out you were going and then I was, he's like, I want to go.
Yeah.
And he's asked, you know, it's like, can we, you know, can I go with you afterwards? I was like, yeah, come on. And so, but anyway, we were sitting down at this table, or it was me and him, and there were two C's. It's like, hey, can I sit down? And the guys are like, oh, yeah, you're Todd. We saw you on Mirai Live. And I was like, yeah. And so I was like, oh, where are you guys from? And they're like, oh, we're from Switzerland. It's like, I've always wanted, like, if people ask, where do you want to go? It's like, I want to go to Norway. And I want to go to the Swiss Alps.
Uh-huh.
It's like those are two big things because I want to go look at the old larches. And so I was telling them, you know, it's like, oh, Switzerland is always, it's a place that I want to go to and go look at the larches. And they're, one of the guys was like, well, come over next year. And it's like, we'll host you and we'll take you up there and we'll do workshops. And I was like, when? And it's like, well, September. It's like, okay, let's. And so we were sitting at the table and we just booked it right then.
Wow.
So I was like, huh, well.
Wow.
So I'm going to Switzerland, and then, like, I'm going to go back to Michael Tran's place and go, like, and do that Generation Bonsai and go to Danny's place. And so, yeah, just, I'm trying to.
I want to go to Michael Tran's place well, so bad. He posted a larch the other day on Instagram that I was just like, jeez.
Yeah. Yeah.
The guy's got great trees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does. He does. And
he's supposed to be coming here in November. At least that was our very unprofessional tentative plan. Like, hey, Michael, come to Mirai in November and bring Jan and Tom.
Yeah.
It was like, I don't know how official that is, but I'm hoping somebody makes that happen.
Well, I think we're, waiting on you.
Oh, you are?
To get dates, because I sent you dates. God, and it's like, okay, I knew. Go before. I'm not going to book anything during this time, because then we can go on a little field trip
or
something.
If you don't remind me 10 times, I'm pretty much incapable of making plans. So. I'm so sorry.
This year, too, it's going back to some of the... That's what's fun, too, is going back to some of the same collections I've seen, you know, and that I've worked on for the last couple years. So,
Do you want it to be at the beginning of November or the end of November?
Details are getting ironed out right now.
Here, I'll have to look at my phone. Because I think we talked about before, because then I would go...
Because I've got the first weekend of October, or the first weekend of November, literally November 1st.
No.
The day after Halloween. You can't? When can
you? Hold on. California. So it'd have to be...
The last weekend?
Before the 15th. Yeah, so the... So
before the 15th, so the 15th, first,
Sorry. The 15th, I'm in California.
So the first, the weekend of the first, second, and third?
Yeah, that's fine. California.
And there it is.
Winning. Winning.
There it is.
We just won, Josh.
Puget Sound.
We won. Woo! All right, there it is.
Tom Yon and
Michael Tran. Michael.
Those are your
dates. Yes, November. We're going to plan around that. I'm going to send them an email. I'm going to send them an email right now. Right on the podcast, there's an email going out making sure that we have these people coming. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting. So
game on.
Yeah. I don't know if I have Michael Tran's. You don't have Michael Tran's. Well, remind me. Anyways.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
So.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yep.
Wow.
But this year, too, I debated whether I, like, pull back on travel.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I didn't feel right about that. I didn't feel that this year was that year. And so I think next year I might adjust my business model as to what that looks like.
Somebody told me one time in business, wait until you absolutely have to before you make a big change. Like, don't do, and I don't, that is not at all like what I would consider to be utterly sound advice, but like when... taking on expenses, adding a new employee, etc. There is a strategy in business to wait until you absolutely have to. And I think, like, when I transitioned away from traveling as a professional, I traveled as long as I possibly could have without having Mirai collapse. And when I pulled back at a point where if I didn't pull back, the garden that I had worked so hard to build via traveling was going to start to really suffer.
Yeah.
And so it was like I went as long as I possibly could. And I think, like, more than as a sound strategy, because proactively sort of tapering off travel and being more strategic about it would have been far better. But more than that, I think what it did was give me the peace of mind in pulling back from travel. That was like, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. I did it as long as I possibly could have. There was no, it almost wasn't even a choice. It wasn't even an option. Mm-hmm. It was just what had to happen. And I felt a lot of resolve about that professional decision, you know, and pulling back from travel and focusing more on being at Mirai was a difficult transition. Not for me in terms of like where I wanted to be. I obviously want to be working on trees in the garden and teaching students here on site. Just because I'm able to teach and give them a lot better experience with the sort of facility that's here. But, you know, there's a monetary tipping point
Sure.
where you have that scale where you're going to
sort of shut down dependable income and put your faith in people coming and, you know, slowly building that over the course of time. But that was a big question mark and sort of concerning aspect of it. And then I think beyond that, in terms of that transition, you really now are sort of forced to practice bonsai like a bonsai professional, mm-hmm. not like a traveling, you know, performer.
Right.
I mean, more or less as a traveling bonsai professional, that's not really being a bonsai professional. That's being a traveling workshop instructor.
Yeah.
When you're at home all of a sudden with your trees, there's accountability because you technically have the time to be doing that work when it should be being done and doing mm-hmm. it well. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, I now actually have to figure this out.
Right.
But it was a beautiful change mm-hmm. for me anyways.
Yeah. No, that's good advice. That's good advice. Yeah, I wouldn't like just cut it off,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's like, oh, maybe I block out a couple weekends a month and, you know, and
that's a transition, yeah, right? Like you make that time to be at home and start building that. Yeah. And yeah, I think you have to.
And see about people like coming to me, but then still travel, you know, still they'll still be travel. And I like the travel.
Sure.
You know,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
When you develop those relationships with people and get to, and they support you and you know, that's really a fantastic, yeah. beautiful aspect of bonsai.
It's very rewarding. And, yeah,
I think the thing that people don't often realize about travel is because there's an impression like, well, you're getting paid to just be traveling and like doing what you love. And it's like, yes, this is true. And nobody should be taking that for granted. But what people don't understand about that experience is that when you're traveling and you're consistently giving your creativity, giving your technique, giving your physical, you know, efforts towards something, as much as you appreciate the opportunity and the relationships and the work, traveling means that you're not getting back sort of the payback of what bonsai and all of that investment replenishes.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get that time with the tree. You don't get to spend that enjoyment. You don't get the fruits of your labor in terms of being present with that living work of art that you just invested all of that in. You move to the next place where you again dump all of that energy and that creativity and that physical exertion. And then you move to the next place and you do it again and again. Mm-hmm. And the model of the traveling professional is one of severe creative, emotional, and physical energy depletion.
Mm-hmm.
And when that well runs dry, it's very, very difficult to replenish it.
Yeah.
And I think inside of that too, there's an artistic stagnation. There's a lot of emotional challenges that come with that,
yeah.
you know, and that's where I think there's some metal to be earned being on the road, learning how to cope with that uncomfortable
yeah.
aspect of yeah. the traveling professional. But then there's also a point where there's a necessity for self-preservation. And that's a weird tipping point to hit because, you know, like when I pulled back, I had relationships with a lot of people and a lot of people felt very betrayed by me pulling back. And it was very confusing for me because it was like, well, I thought that, you know, each person that I was working for was like, you got to slow down, you got to slow down, you got to slow down. We don't want to see anything bad happen to you. We don't want to see you, you know, run yourself ragged, burn out, or have physical issues as mm-hmm. a result of, you know, what you're doing. And then you pull back. And a lot of those people were the first people to say, you're not coming anymore. How dare you? And it's like, well, wait, but didn't you tell me to slow down?
Yeah.
Oh, that didn't apply to you.
Right.
Right. And that was a really interesting experience. And I understand a lot of how people could have felt like, you know, I said that, but it wasn't about, you know, that was about the people that don't matter. And it's like, well, but everybody matters to yeah. you when you're a professional, yeah. you know,
I'm here.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be here if I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So this is a tough balance, you know, and it's also something that I think people out there that are supporting professionals, obviously there's all kinds of dynamics and stuff, and professionals need the support of students and clients and patrons. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's an interesting dynamic that forms there in those interpersonal relationships and stuff. But I also think that it's very hard to understand what it looks like for a traveling professional. From somebody that's never been a traveling bonsai professional, it's very difficult to understand everything that I just sort of put out there. And it's not something that I think a lot of professionals choose to talk about, because it's a very slippery slope and you don't want to damage those interpersonal dynamics and stuff. But if nobody ever talks about it, then nobody's ever put it out there for people to be aware of and be understanding of, and hopefully just discussing it, you know, shed some light on what it's like to try and make those decisions for yourself.
And I mean, and the people are, you know, as I'm going around and they're like, oh, you're living your dream. It's like, yes, I am.
Uh-huh.
I absolutely am, you know, and I wouldn't change a thing, you know, but then going into my, like, still like everything, I was talking to Colton and he's like, we're so proud of you here and we hear you, you know, and it's like, yeah, I appreciate that. And it's like, it's only been 2 years.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going into my third season. Like, this is my third season of travel, but, you know, and it's like, I'm pretty honest and I like wear my emotions on my sleeve, but yes, I'm living my dream, but it can be tough at times, you know?
And living your dream in peaches and cream, man.
No, it's not.
And that's
people think it is. It's like, oh, but you travel and it's like, you're getting paid to do bonsai and you can stay in hotels and this and that. And it's like, yes. And I do cherish all that.
Mm-hmm.
But at times, like you were saying, like with like emotional, and it's like, I hadn't really thought about that, but when you're going and you're giving all the time, it's like, yeah, you don't always have time to to fill your well back up.
Yep.
And it's like, I hadn't thought about that till you said that. It's like, yeah, there's some like mental battles that you have to go through when you're traveling that much. I mean, last year I was 250, 280, 280 days.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that's
hard.
It is.
It's hard. And you know, people can look at it and be like, oh, it's so hard. You're doing what you love. You know, it's like, nah, I'm sorry. It doesn't look like that. Yeah. Like, it is. It's a commitment to be a bonsai professional, and it's great. And also, there's no one thing that is just all good. You do have to deal with that. And I think this is where, you know, we talk about a professionals organization from the perspective of, you know, protecting professionals. But I think this is where having relationships inside of bonsai as a profession is so important and imperative, just to be able to have people that you know understand and relate to what it is we're all giving as professionals, because it is. I mean, we are choosing to share, you know, our creativity and our efforts. And thank goodness there are people out there that care enough and value what we can do to support us and allow us to do it, right?
Yep.
So it is this beautiful marriage of that challenge to do so in a way that we can sustain. And but it is an interesting one.
Yeah. I mean, and I've talked to like Mauro and I've talked to Bjorn and just been like, I have a new appreciation for what you guys do, you know, after getting into this, because people don't understand that. And, you know, and it's like I've used both, but like I talk to you all the time and it's like, I'll be driving. It's like, oh, I wonder what, you know, I don't know if he has classes or it's after or before I'm going to call Ryan, you know? So it's like, I rely on you a lot too, because you've used Six Gear for so long, you know? So it's like, all right, I can talk to Ryan about this, you know? So it really is having like someone that you can when you're stressed out or when you're tired or when you're down or, you know, mm-hmm. that you can talk to and be like, I'm feeling like this. And they're like, yep, I've been there too. And it's like, you know, so someone to help, like a community or a, just a person that you have a lot of respect for that you can just bounce ideas off and that you know they're not. It's like with you, it's like you're my friend, you know, it's like when I'm here, it's all yes or no, sir. But like, but we're friends, buds, you know? So it's like, I know any advice you give me is experiences that you've had and looking after me, not like giving me some, you know, like, well, you have pride. And so I'm not going to give him this piece of information that I really struggled with, you know? So it's like, it's just, it's.
Yeah. That stuff is bullshit as far as I'm concerned.
No, but like people do, you know, it's like, oh, I have my pride. I'm not going to tell him this and that, you know, it's like.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's,
No, I definitely, you know, when I was in Japan with my apprenticeship, it was super painful to get through that apprenticeship. And yesterday that gentleman came up to the garden and wanted to talk about the realities of being an apprentice in Japan with somebody who I know very well in Japan as a very strict Kimura school centric individual, and he's hard to apprentice with. He's going to be any apprentice of Mr. Kimura is going to who has successfully completed an apprenticeship with Mr. Kimura is going to be on another level of skill set and artistry, and is also going to be on another level of discipline and just that hardcore gnarliness that allowed them to endure an apprenticeship with Mr. Kimura, because he really does make you leather hard, you know? And it was interesting.
But you don't have that.
I do have that. I just have worked really hard to sort of, you know, as far as my mental health and emotional health and stuff, it's something that I have to work at really hard. It's not, people don't talk about, people talk about the physical aspect and working out or staying in shape or stuff like that. But there's a whole mental health, emotional health aspect of life in general that isn't discussed openly in the United States. And it's probably the biggest thing that I've had to work at. And I recognize in Japan, had I not had Peter Warren and had I not had the parents that I have, I wouldn't have survived my apprenticeship. They really supported me. And I very much recognize coming back that, you know, seeing a therapist and a counselor once a week and going and sitting in the float tank as much as I can is the biggest single thing that I do for myself personally, but also probably the biggest single thing that I do for myself as a bonsai professional to be able to continue to do this. And I absolutely believe in that stuff.
I do,
and I think there's a real stigma around taking care of yourself from a mental health perspective that exists, and I think it's a shame, because why wouldn't you do that? You know, and as a bonsai professional, giving and giving and giving, as the career demands, there has to be a time where the well gets filled back up,
right?
You know, and where you're just taking care of yourself.
And I talk to a counselor once a week when I'm on the road.
Yeah,
like even like maybe I have a travel day, and it's like Bob. His name's Bob.
My counselor's name's Bob too.
Really?
Yeah.
I have a layover, and I have like an hour and a half. Can I call you on this day from this time to this time? So it's like I have an ongoing weekly meeting with him, you know? And it's like just a, I don't know, like that was a thing over winter where it's like I work and work and work and work, and then it's like all of a sudden it was slow.
Yeah.
And so, and then it was cold, and then it was, you know, and it's like you go a little crazy, you know? And so, like having, I don't know, it's like having maybe some like internal things that I hadn't worked through, you know, and it's like stuff like that. And then when you're home and you're able to reflect and, you know, and then you get anxious or maybe you get a little depressed and, you know, and it's like, it's real. And seasonal depression, I mean, like October when I took my trees down because I, it was going to get to 28 and I was going to be in Texas. And it's like, this is the day I hate the most.
Yep.
When I have to take everything and put it on the ground because I know I'm going into a big dormancy time where it's like, I'll see you guys in a few months, you know? And it's like that I struggle with that. And so, I don't know. And it's like, I know there's a lot of people out there that struggle with that and struggle with, you know, anxiety or depression and, absolutely, you know, just in general. So it's like, that's something, I don't know. I struggle with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's real, man. It is very real.
But it's like becoming, like, that's one thing that I'm like for, like mentally focusing on. It's like just being comfortable in my own skin.
Sure.
Like that's a big thing that I'm working on, like for this year, or I don't know. It's like, who knows how long that that's
probably a lifelong.
It's
goal,
a lifelong.
Right?
Yeah. It'll just be a lifelong thing. So
just part of the process of self-improvement in life. I mean, I was talking with, the gentleman who came to talk about the apprenticeship, and we were talking, maybe I was talking with Will about it last night, and there was, you know, through my apprenticeship, sort of this point, even in the 4-year mark, where I was like, man, if somebody saw me now, the expectation of what I could do versus what I can actually do are two totally different things. Mm. They would expect me to be able to do the work that Mr. Kimura can do, and I can barely do the work that a really advanced hobbyist could do. You know, at the 4-year mark of my apprenticeship, this is 4 years with Mr. Kimura, that I'm still very low level in terms of my thought of myself. And then, you know, that shift happened where sort of finding comfort in my own skin, at least as far as my bonsai skills were concerned, and there's a whole sort of, you know, backstory to that shift that happened for me. But when that happened, that was when sort of the handcuffs came off.
Yeah.
And it was really freeing to have that weight of self-doubt lifted off of me in my apprenticeship. And that same sort of cyclical accumulation of all of that weight and garbage has happened multiple times at Mirai. And the past 2 years have been very challenging for me at Mirai. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of personal things happening and trying to make Mirai Live function as well as it can and learn how to, you know, just work with more people, learn how to operate a business, just everything.
Yeah.
Right? At first, it was learning how to operate a nursery and be a traveling professional. And then it was learning how to be an instructor with a school on site that carries the majority of the load. And then it was learning how to operate a live streaming educational platform and work with a expanded team. And that cyclical accumulation, I look at it now and I'm like, oh, okay, this is never going to stop.
No, it's not.
This is never going to stop.
No.
But the one thing that I have recognized through all of it is if I don't give myself the time to dispose of the mental garbage, then it's going to accumulate. And I think that's that sort of, you were going into winter season and you had a momentum of a train that had been taking on all of the mental garbage. Yeah. And when it stopped and that came roaring at you with that momentum, it was freaking
gnarly. The
train
didn't stop.
Train didn't stop. Well, the momentum carried all of that and put it immediately on your plate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that for me with travel, that was where I couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't. I couldn't, because being away and being on the road and being on and sort of putting all of that energy out there, as much as I loved it, all of the stuff that I wasn't addressing in my life that was accumulating was starting to become way too overwhelming, and it was detrimenting the capacity for Mirai to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. But when, and when that train hit, like there were a couple things that I'd done or like personal struggles in my life, you know, but that I looked, when this came, I knew what was coming. And so it's like, okay, what's your approach to it? So like when the train collided and the momentum kept coming, then it was like, okay, there's a lot of good that will come out of this.
Sure.
If you look for it. And so like, that's what I would say to anyone that like just deals with anxiety or depression. It's like, my dad sent me this thing, and It was a podcast from, I forget who the gentleman was, but basically what he said was the deeper the hole that you're in, the greater possibility for personal growth once you get out.
Oh.
So.
That's lemonade out of lemons right there.
Yeah, and so that's how, like, I had to look at this. It's yeah. like, when I come out of this, and it's still, like, it's a struggle. It's like, I'm doing so much better. You uh-huh. know, I feel better. Probably part of it is because spring's coming. I'm,
you know, we probably, all feel better.
Yeah, it's like, we all feel thank better. God that spring is here, you know, and like, working and, you know, just being, like, active again and getting out of, you know, that mindset, but also, like, knowing that when I get through this, it's like you're more self-confident. You know mm-hmm. more about yourself. You're more complete. You're a more healed person. You know, it's yep. like you're not necessarily, I don't want to use the term better, mm-hmm. you know, because it's like I'm not bad, but it's like you become a more rounded person. And so mm-hmm. that's kind of how I look at, and it's like I wouldn't have gotten to that point if I was still probably at my corporate job,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's like the whole, I'm going to quit my corporate job to do Bonsai to see what I'm made of. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden, this winter, it's like, okay, let's see what you're made of.
What are you made of?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was a big culmination of, it's a great period of growth for me.
Yeah.
That's how I believe this period is. So,
well, this is, again, like, I'm sure really any passionate pursuit or endeavor would challenge people in the same way. We've chosen Bonsai, and so Bonsai mm-hmm. to me is mm-hmm. an art form that encourages this self-growth and sure. self-reflection and development. And Mr. Kimura used to always say, I'm not teaching you Bonsai, I'm teaching you to be a stronger human, right? Yeah. I'm strengthening your heart was his big sort of punchline for when he really shit on us as apprentices, how we were supposed to find acceptance in that.
Right.
You can't fault the guy. Any apprentice that's finished with Mr. Kimura is, again, a leather-hard, gnarly, durable yeah. person who's probably going to be successful and not really go away when the challenges hit. But there's also repercussions sure. from that, right?
Sure.
You have to deal with that. That's a big part of it. But I think, all in all, Bonsai, it's very romantic to think about doing Bonsai professionally. Like, you know, you can see the Karate Kid with Ralph Macchio, you know, making fences, wax on, wax off, mm-hmm. you know, and Mr. Miyagi and the music and the sunset and the crane kick. You know, like, you can see yourself, like, wiring trees and carrying, and this is hard work. And the romance around that is so beautiful, you know, but, and the idea of doing Bonsai as a profession is so beautiful. The seasonality and the building of a garden and making tree, but the reality of it is, you know, seeing what you're made of, pursuing this as a profession, the downside of that is not very romantic.
No.
It's very challenging to yeah. do Bonsai for a living. And I feel like every time we podcast, I walk away with just even more respect for you as one of my students. It's like seeing you grow, man, seeing you get stronger, seeing you evolve as a person. I'm so freaking proud of you, Todd. I am proud of you, man. You are doing great, dude.
Yep.
And you are doing something that nobody else has really done yet. You didn't go to Japan and do that apprenticeship. You're a self-made Bonsai professional who's just killing the game right now,
yeah.
you know? And to test yourself and say, what am I made of? Like, pretty impressive, dude. Pretty darn impressive. Yeah. I'm proud of you, man.
No, thanks. And it does. It comes back to my dad, you know, who planted the seed, you know?
Yeah.
Money's not an issue. You can do anything you want. What would you do?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. 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 Embrace the struggle, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
Yep. Thank you.
I thoroughly love our coffee cast.
I do too.
This has become a real thing.
This is, yeah.
It's real. Like it. We checked on the hashtag yeah. CoffeeCast, and we recognize, as unoriginal as we felt like we were, nobody's really using CoffeeCast outside
no.
of talking about coffee. So
yeah.
This is another monumental yeah. addition to the
new hashtag.
We have yeah. a new thing going yeah. on. We got the CoffeeCast.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to another two big days with
yep.
you, brother.
Me
and
too.
I love you tons.
I love you too.
Couldn't be more proud of you,
yep.
man.
Thank you.
All right,
you.
Todd.